Haluaisin kiittää järjestäjiä kutsusta. Tämä on suuri ilo tulla Suomeen puhumaan konferenssiin. Jyväskylässä mä en ollut koskaan puhumassa. Ja vaikka on jossain yhteistyössä aina professorikollegani kanssa, Janne Vilkunan. Tällä kertaa tulen poikkeamaan tavoistani ja istumaan aika paljon, koska minulla on vähän huonot jalat. Toinen poikkeama on, että suurin osa teksteistäni on PowerPointissa. Että se on vähän tortta po tortta, mutta tekee sen ehkä helpommaksi seurata. This is in English, though we have two official languages in this country, but it seems that the Swedish has gone down, so we have to move to English. Maybe English will be a second official language in Finland after a while. Yeah, I have also a few double things going on here. For a presentation, I could just say that I am a historian, mainly interested in cultural history, philosophy, history of thought and ideas. So my perspective will be a rather large one into this topic. So as far as it comes to museums and their doings, I have a few concerns which are my point of interest, focus of interest. One is the widespread feeling that the civilizations of mankind are on decline, as if the world we have created is all there, our work finished, and our main task is to stop it from vanishing, to protect and preserve it. As if there were no future, nothing more to come. This situation has created a kind of modern perversion in my mind. The idea of eternal preservation of all that is or is thought to be solid. Following this, another concern is the ever-growing museum boom all over the world, with millions and billions of objects in collections and storages, objects that we believe should be accessible to the masses, but nevertheless also protected from them. Once in a museum, an object is lost for usage in the world outside. I'm interested in the big scope of our relation to material objects. And materiality in general. There is a kind of dichotomy which I will start with here in order to understand the society we create. Two kinds of depot for material objects. One is the museum and the other is the dump or garbage heap. This is a matter of concern, really. We have these two depots. One is collecting things we want to preserve. The other is collecting things we don't want to preserve. We want to get rid of. But it's still there, and very much so. This image is from Freshkills in New York. The garbage dump of the city, which would be called one of the monstrous monuments of civilization. And you can see the amount volume compared to the Great Pyramid at Giza. And this is for sure preserved for eternity, because there is no oxygen down there, and nothing will be gone. All right, what do we preserve and what do we throw away and why? Often a question of chance, of so-called sattuma. And this dichotomy is kind of a very interesting phenomenon in modernity, in our dealings with objects and materiality. Museums start very early, so one could start wondering, what does a museum collect, or what did it collect? One of my favorite catalogs, you know, is this, which you cannot read, but it's a wonderful sample of the ethnographic department of Västernorrlands Läns Museum up in Härnösand. The old catalog from the 90s says there are all sorts of things. A knife, I just put a sample, I tell you a sample of this text. A knife with a delicately carved shaft of walrus tooth from the 12th century, sticks with rune inscriptions, wooden boxes, altar cabinet, a ship model from the 18th century, images of angels, wall clocks, a milk bottle for journeys, forks and spoons, a potato mill, chandelier of iron and tree, candle holder of crockery, a barrel of earthenware, weapons of all kinds, pulpit, paintings from peasant homes, woolen caps, playing cards, jugs, tools, etc., etc. All in one kind of a trash heap, if you will, here. So we always speak about the catalogs as a mirror of knowledge. Well, These examples are from the same museum and from one of my doctoral students, now made his dissertation, Katalogen nyckeln till museernas kunskap. I mean, it's very interesting to see these items, borrskaft, a shaft for a drill. So. And some other small, and there are lots and lots and lots of these things. One might ask, where's the context? Do we need these objects, really? Are they important? Nothing happens. Okay. Did I do something? Mikä tapahtui? Stuck. Okay. So too much stuff, perhaps. It's a starting point. We all know that. Museums are bellying by the weight of their collections. In the United States, the public museums alone possess 750 to 800 million objects. In the United Kingdom, about this amount. Just one single example, the University Collection of London Museum. There is 380,000 objects. Well, my examples in many parts of this is from Sweden. I don't know Finland so very well as for the numbers. So, only the so-called homeland associations, Kotiseutumuseot, 1.5 million objects. The History Museum of Stockholm, 10 to 20 million. The National Museum, 700,000, and so on. Well, I'm also interested in the paradox between the governmental instructions for museums to collect and then the idea of preservation for 1,000 years, which is stipulated in Sweden as for instruction for the museums, that things should be preserved for at least 1,000 years. So, is this really, well, too much stuff? It happens to be chairs again here. And, but this is a very neatly ordered and new storage room for Gotland's Fornsal. Well, one of the obstacles in the traditional museum paradigm is the axiomatic idea of this eternal preservation. Nobody asks actually why on earth we think the future generations would be interested in all that scrap of our time. Nobody asks why we want to reserve those objects for them. It is when it is us who actually need them in our therapeutic interaction with the past. We are grown up in the industrial society, of at least me, of the 20th century. The traumatic, as I call it, relationship to objects and to time and to the past is something that concerns us. We actually know nothing about how our children and grand and great grandchildren will think about the past, about objects. Do they think we are crazy? Or what? Having left everything for them, and not now. I don't speak only about museum collection, but also those garbage heaps. I mean, imagine an archaeologist in 500 years digging in such a heap. Wow, what might they think about our lives? A colleague of mine once said, until now, our pivotal motive has been the feeling that our heritage is threatened and has to be protected. But from what? Well, from humans. But to declare the heir incapable to protect the heritage is not a sustainable base for antiquarian thinking, which for me is kind of going to the core of this phenomenon. A new way of antiquarian thinking, in addition to other thinking, would be to let people, other people, not only museum professionals, decide what they want to preserve and how. For instance, does the Nordic Museum in Stockholm need 350 spinning wheels? Or would perhaps 25 be enough? And what about an equal amount of similar lanterns or whatever objects? As for the spinning wheels, I mean, all, particularly good question, when all those homeland associations and museums, kotiseutumuseot, also possess a couple of thousand of spinning wheels. Left for the future generations. So, just as a question, why are these kept in storage, really? Why is the crucial question, in my view. Okay, we had a nice speech about disposal before me here, and I didn't intend to discuss the practice of disposal, but just give you a hint of these two books, disposal toolkits, guidelines for museums at the Museum Association in United Kingdom have published, and a very useful book is this, Museums and the Disposals Debate, a collection of essays where also a lot of questions are discussed. Well, I just wanted to list a set of questions that the previous my speaker already talked about in Norway, so I will not dig into these so much. But give just an example of disposal in University College in London. Those 380,000 objects consist of geology, archaeology, ethnography, and they have huge problems with storage, conservation, etc. So they made an inventory showed that an enormous amount of objects were in a state of oblivion and decay and never used, and they lacked context. As for being used, all those millions or billion objects in United States and United Kingdom, they have made a calculation that only 5% of all those objects in museums will ever be showed or used in any way, which also puts a perspective in what they are there for. Why are they there if only 5% ever will be used or showed in any way, which is quite an interesting perspective. Well, in London they made an exhibition called Disposal, was arranged with ambition to invite visitors into the process. They chose five groups of objects: old geological instrument, a skull of a hippopotamus, replicas, oops, not real, but replicas of dog skulls, and a pair of cowboy boots, and they put these on display. Visitors were invited, and they had to vote. What could we let go? Well, after the visitors were given information about the objects, they changed the attitude from a merely positive to disposal. It shifted to negative. No, these are very important items. You couldn't let go. So there we are. In Swedish, one would say "Där sitter vi på pottkanten med våra prylar." What could we do, and what should we do? So I will get back to my motto: if you don't use the stuff and it does not serve your purpose, why do you spend money taking care of it? I'm always interested in this small word, why. Why is it so difficult to deaccess and thin out the collections? What is this all about? And which are the factors, obstacles, and the factors and mechanism of inertia and impediment? Jarrutusmekanismit. I'm interested in these jarrutusmekanismit, obstacles for change in museums in general, because there is a certain kind of war going on within many, at least big institutions, on the matters of change. In general, So the rest of my time here I'm going to speak about, I'm going to discuss these theoretical tools on the road. On the road to disposal, if you will. Kind of a bedrock of it all is the interdependence between social, between society and the museum, social, political, cultural, and scientific structures, and how a society perceives things, life, and the past. And these structures are giving a culture of science which steer the paradigms and discourses and a given way of thinking, if you will. So there are a few, four kind of questions I'm going to point at. Us and our things, a phenomenological approach, Heidegger, Gadamer. The second is what is called thought collective and thought style, Tanke collective, Tanke stil by Ludwig Fleck. And then comes the tacit knowledge, practical knowledge, where with the theorists Michael Polanyi in Sweden, Ture Nordenstam, Kjell Johannessen, and some others. And the fourth, organization is important. Organizational culture, how an institution thinks. So, first is it's this core of it all, our relation to things. Things with which people interact are not simply tools for survival or for making survival easier and more comfortable. Things embody also goals, make skills manifest and shape the identity of of the users. We are not only Homo sapiens or Homo ludens, the playing man. We are also Homo faber, the maker and user of objects. Ourself is to a large extent a reflection of things with which we interact every day. Objects also make and use their makers and users. In everyday life, we act through things, and together with them, we situate ourselves in time and space. For Heidegger, the purpose of an object is its life as equipment, Zeug, in Swedish, don. And this is for intentional action. Equipment for intentional action, and the object as equipment is called in Swedish, donens donvaro, deras tillvaro. For us. As a prefix to all artifacts, one could add with which to do something, or as Gadamer would say, in order to do, in order to. These equipments make our daily life easier as we use them in intentional, communicative, and social action. The purpose of an artifact is its life as ready at hand in phenomenological words. It kind of lays there with a friendly attitude and waits to be used. Well, it's also a social act. Although material culture may be produced by individuals, it's a social production as well. It's socially produced and as such, an emphasis is being placed on the constructedness of human meaning as a product of shared systems of signification. We are in a constant interrelationship with objects, in short. So here is from a small museum out in Holmen in Sweden, where objects are, so to say, put, displayed as they should be in real life, ready at hand in a seal hunting boat. They are there with their mates and objects used to be together. Well, there is a lot of talk of the process of mutualization, that it changes the purpose of an object into kind of raw material for representation, signs and symbols of something else. Many people, as for example Theodor Adorno, is talking about killing an object when cutting off the life cycle of it out in real life. So the word museal describes an object which is in a state of decay or dying. I'm interested in whether this is true or not. So what does a classical museum do to objects? Well, this image is from Nordic Museum in the about 1910, so it's of course a very classical. An object picked out of its natural habitat, the ready-at-hand relationship with human action, is no longer seen as an utility or equipment, they say. But it gains its value in an artificial world of taxonomic and cognitive abstraction. The meaning of a thing will be mostly forever fixed, or will it, is my suspicious question. I have begun to think that this statement is kind of an ideological fallacy. The museum is not very different from surroundings. A museum treats objects in many respects in the same way as we do outside. Museum professionals think primarily of the object as being useful, potentially at least. The only difference is that in a museum, the idea is that objects would be useful merely for science, perhaps, or as testimony of lived life, not actually for us in our everyday lives. But anyway, we might need them, all those 800 million objects in United States museums. Maybe. We cannot throw them away because you never know. Even if they are mute right now, one fine day they might open their hearts and tell us something. We treat objects as if they actually were alive, not telling us all they know, keeping secrets. Sometimes they like us, sometimes they don't. We have a very vivid and intimate relationship to objects, and I don't think that it's different in the museum for museum professionals and conservators. So that's an intriguing question. And more important, museum professionals treat objects as their own property. Correct me if I'm wrong. They care for them. That these are our heritage. Well, that's some thoughts about the relationship to objects, and I will continue with this Fleck, Ludwig Fleck, theoretician who came up with the thought of a thought collective, thought style, thought collective, and scientific community. It's a group of people who exchange and share ideas and thoughts and keep up and are in reciprocal action with one another. Bearers of the history of a specific field of thought constitute a thought style, tankestil. And as such, they form also a thought collective, a professional thought collective as such, in scientific fields, for instance. Only there the scope and buoyancy of facts and new ideas can be tested and manifested. So there is a sum of experiences which also were in constant process of change, but within the collective. And it's kind of only when the collective decides that they allow new thoughts to be true, then also the scientific paradigm changes. Which is important in the museum, in my view, very much so, because most museums and museum professionals have a scientific education from the university in some field close to the purpose of the museum, be it archaeology, art, ethnology, or whatever. And one idea with this scientific community or thought collective is to never underestimate the strength of these, where the paradigmatic truths usually thrive. And then, as I said, archaeological or ethnological museum, they are trained in a specific way. A scientific community, thought collective, is very steady and firm, not at all apt to change their minds in front of other arguments. Material things are priceless for these professionals in museums, as you, I suppose you are here in my audience. Objects are potentially useful, bearers of our past. And here kind of is where the agony pops up. Agony of letting go, throw, or thin out. It was first our intimate relationship to things in the phenomenological way. Then comes this also thought collective, thought style, scientific community that makes it, that is very stiff usually and makes it very difficult to change. And all here said forms also what we would call tacit knowledge, hiljainen tieto, tyst kunskap, combined with practical knowledge, which is in a museum, as I believe Nina Robbins will tell us also more about, is very, very, what would I say, an important thing to remember, that this is what kind of steers and reins our behavior in a museum and our behavior with the collections. Our behavior, behind our behavior is very often this tacit knowledge, which might be the collective thought style, scientific community, or just how we used to do things. A knowledge of how we used to do, knowing how, not only knowing what. But to this field of questions and problems is always crucial the question why, which is rarely actually asked, or maybe asked, but we don't go to the core of it. Why? What's the big purpose of all this? So then about a few words about how the institution thinks, which is a wonderful book by Mary Douglas, How Institutions Think is the title of it. I will give you a list of books at the end of my presentation here. So, just read this. If museums, well, it's a wonderful quotation about aspects of change in museums. If the term museum is going to mean something in the future, museums of today must be willing to alter and to modify their internal structure and their ideas to fit the changing world conditions and the advances in social thought. Museums have failed to do this and have shown a most extraordinary reluctance to accept new social theories and new social ideas. Sounds familiar, does it? I have picked this quotation not because it's of its originality, but because it's representativity of the criticism directed towards museum, and this is from 1942. Not today as it could be. And this actually quotation could be from anywhere from the 1880s onward. Already in the 1900, these kind of complaints were made. It's not time. I don't have time here to go deep into this, but it's a very intriguing question. If they have difficulties to change, why is that so? And is that true? I don't think it's true, but people out there think it's true. But there is this very intriguing question of professionalism tied to this thought styles and scientific communities I was talking about. In the case of museums, the professionals are gatekeepers, of course, of scientific thought and practice, simultaneously providing and controlling access to information. In any profession, members have a tendency to equate their own solutions to particular problems with deep truths about the world. What I think is the truth. Professional behavior is guided by a set of norms about what an institution is. An institution confers identity. It forms a kind of we, us, in here, do it things this way. Mayor Douglas defines an institution as a legitimized social grouping where legitimized authority resides. A professional is someone who receives important occupational rewards from a reference group. This is the inner dynamics of the thought collective, if you like, in the museum. We get occupational rewards from a reference group whose membership is to people to have undergone specialized formal education and have accepted a group-defined code of proper conduct. Other people should not come and mess around in the museum. It's us who know. This very much differentiates the professional from the populace and their needs in a profession. Clay Shirky notes, I give you his title also, a very interesting book. Members are only partly guided by service to the public, which is something to remember and think about. We are more apt to serve our community, our inner circles, than to serve the public, which is just not my opinion, it's Shirky's research results. They have more important things to do. A professional outlook can sometimes become a disadvantage, preventing the very people who have the most at stake, the professionals themselves, from understanding major changes to the structure of their profession. Maybe have to read it twice. Well, this very fact can, in my view, be one of the most important factors hindering deaccession and disposal from collections. Because at some level, we all want to dispose of things. We want to thin out the collections. But when it comes to the practical matter, it's difficult. The agony is hindering us. What's happening? No. We have to preserve this. This could be useful. And then there is the public to opinion to consider. Well, I think my time is running out soon, is it? Anyway, here's some about which is important to see a museum as an open work. It's to recognize that it's always discovered by its users in an unfinished state. I like this concept of a laboratory. It could be a laboratory or a workshop for cognitive change. A setting where the museum offers tools, materials, and processes for systematic exploratory approaches to experience and purposive thought. The Great Museum allows its users to ask and to answer the question, what transformation is possible for me here? And which means has some consequences for how collections are being used. Participatory institution collects and shares diverse personas and changing contexts. I think this went off, did it? No? A museum today speaks of visitors as contributors of collaborating and co-creating together. What consequences would this have for collections is also an interesting question, and for disposal as such. Sharing collections is a very good idea in my view. Split up the collection between several museums if objects fit into their purpose, profile, and goals. Or divide the responsibility, caring, and management. My own favorite idea is that museums could and should start lending out objects. What about that? It's a horrifying idea for conservators. But still, we have those 350 spinning wheels or 500 of this and that in a museum collection, so why not use them? A provocative question, I know. Or deposit them in other institutions such as universities, hospitals, schools, city halls, etc. But all this, of course, requires that we let go of the preservation idea. Something happened, I know. I knew. I will finish just getting back to kind of, the disposal question. So what it means to make people actively participate in heritage business. It requires a widening of the scope of values, norms, and museal traditions between preservation and use. This is the core question here. Museums would be world makers in the same way as historians already are. We make new worlds. We make new history. We produce heritage not only preserve. But how would museums do this? Given that this would ask them to entirely change not only their views, but also their practice and paradigms of collection management and research. They would, or you would, in Hilde Heine's words, be forced to accept an ethos of dislocated meaning. In short, they would be forced to start using and utilizing some of their objects in a new creative way, to release, again, some of them from the museum depositories and from the idea of eternal preservation. Museums possess millions and billions of objects. So what if, for instance, they picked out some and start doing things with them, or pulling them even apart to show visitors how they are used and fabricated? Would this then ruin the whole foundation of their existence? Perhaps not. Perhaps this would be tools to produce new similar objects. To change an entire, and in some cases 200 years old, structure and paradigm of taxonomy, documentation and truth is not easy. To let visitors in, to let them use the collections and contribute to the contents of them, to take the individualistic, self-formative and self-performative visitor of today seriously, well, this requires perhaps more of the museum than they can bear. But to enable the classical museums, stuck in their old scientific paradigms, to undergo a deeper change, they have seriously to start scrutinizing and analyzing their own profession, motives, missions, and policies in relation to their collections and their use, and in relation to modern society. In short, they or we have to question the very origins of our identity. Otherwise, I'm afraid we soon will have a situation where heavy institutions have outlived their own time and purpose. Maybe we will have real museum ruins to take care of and to musealize. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
As this PowerPoint also will be open access on the web, if I understood it rightly, then there you can pick these books, which are some of them I have used here.
May I have one comment?
Comments and questions, yes.
Okay, so I forgot to represent myself. I'm Satu Savia from Helsinki City Museum. Just a comment that it's very important to have a multi-professional group which decides also about the accessioning and the deaccessioning. I mean that, for example, in Helsinki City Museum, we had the conservator, sometime museum pedagogue, and he or she will also participate because they have sometimes used some of the disposed objects in their work. Senior citizens, for example, old photographs are quite nice to have in hand, and then they are disposed, it's possible. So multi-professional group is quite recommended, I think. And of course, curators, we do the disposal process together. so that we meet once in a while, and it will be discussed in all the angles, and then the decision is made. And of course, the destroyal is the last way to dispose anything. So nothing new to do, but anyway, I want to tell you about this.
Yes.
Hello, my name is Dinah Eastop, and I'm an honorary senior lecturer at University College London, the collection with 380,000 objects. I just wanted to say that the film Toy Story 2 by Disney Pixar is a very important representation of some of the debates, the important debate that you're introducing.
All right.
Where the toy cowboy, Woody, who has seen Toy Story 2? Okay, yeah. Many people will know Woody. He has to decide at one point, should he remain a museum artifact? I'll start another way around. Should he be accept a future as being a museum artifact, to live his life behind glass, being watched by lots of Japanese children? Or should he go back to being a toy, to resume his life as a toy, to be played with, to function in a particular social environment, but to risk destruction? And it's a beautifully played out debate about these issues. It's a great example.
Sounds wonderful. Was it a film, or what did you say?
It's a film. A film. It's Toy Story 2.
Toy Story 2. Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. Kind of a good example on treating objects as having an own agenda, which is very interesting. And we always actually treat them that way, but not in the museum so often. But at home, we treat the objects as they're really living objects. I mean, they are all friends of mine, and we give them names. And an old armchair could be named Oscar, and don't touch him. He wants no refurbishment, and you know, tapestry. He needs to be exactly. You know, we have lots and lots of objects to which we have a vivid relationship, and I think my mission here would be to treat objects in museums in more in that way. Also, they need to be given a chance to talk their own. In their own respect. Well, yeah. And more questions? Here.
Oh, yes, you know this was coming. The library thing. It's wonderful to hear something very surprising like this. Your idea that why won't be
to lending, lend out objects. Yeah, that's my dream.
Yeah, that would be a way of deaccessioning, like using them until they fall apart, because that's what happens with library books. There's a wear and tear, and eventually they will be.
I know that there are already some art museums out there that do this. You can borrow a painting from it and keep it at home. But I can't give the example now because I don't remember what museum it was. But I've read about it.
Yeah, but anyway, thanks for a very learned talk. That was wonderful to hear. And you went to the mindset of why it is difficult to make the accessioning decisions.
Well, it was to pack a bit big questions into a small package, but I hope it could give some thoughts, provoke some thoughts. Anyway.